Good morning. We have but one case this morning, and that is United States versus Andrews. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Commander Jake Muche, and I represent the appellant in this case, Seaman Apprentice Raiden Andrews. Chief Judge Stuckey, respectfully request 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
The trial counsel committed severe, uncured prosecutorial misconduct, using four types of improper argument to secure a conviction in a sexual assault case on weak evidence. The four types of improper argument were inventing admissions, misstating the law, branding Seaman Andrews as a liar and disparaging him, and accusing defense counsel of not believing their own client. As a result, the members convicted Seaman Andrews not on the evidence, but on the improper arguments of trial counsel.
How do we know that?
Your Honor, there's a three-part test set out in Fletcher that this court uses to establish, to assess prejudice. In going through that analysis, and specifically the severity of the misconduct, this court will assess the impact, the cumulative impact, on that, on the members. And if I may, I'd like to discuss the three factors set out in Fletcher. First, the third factor, the weight of the evidence supporting conviction, and then move to the first two factors, the severity of the misconduct and the curative measures. The government here has argued that the weight of the evidence is overwhelming, and this court should affirm on that basis. However, that is not the case. Here, there is significant evidence that AB was capable of consenting. And in a sexual assault prosecution, specifically on Specification 3, the government was required to prove two things. First, the sexual act, and second, that AB was incapable of consenting due to impairment by alcohol. Regarding the sexual act, the government did not have evidence of the sexual act outside of Seaman Andrews' statement. And that's a big problem in a sexual assault prosecution. So they admit Seaman Andrews' statement. But in doing so, they also admit evidence of consent. Seaman Andrews describes AB as capable of consenting and that she in fact consented to the sexual intercourse. And in a sexual assault prosecution, when the government admits evidence of consent, that is an obstacle. That is a big obstacle for them to overcome. And I would submit to this court that at that point, the government had two options. They either could discredit Seaman Andrews and his statement, or they could try to change his statement. And I know that changing his statement sounds outrageous and not like a real option because that's the truth. But in this case, as you'll see in the invented admissions, that's what happened. But sticking with the weight of the evidence here, the significant evidence that AB was capable of consenting. So if the court looks at the evidence immediately before the sexual intercourse in the bedroom, during the sexual intercourse in the bedroom, and immediately after, and it applies the standard, the definition of incapable of consenting as defined in Pease, there's a different analysis than happens at the lower, than what happened at the lower court. So immediately before the sexual intercourse in the bedroom, and this is in the joint appendix at 172 and 173, Ms. Wade describes AB, describes her as able to respond to questions, is able to give coherent responses, is able to express desires. And then when Seaman Andrews goes into the bedroom, he describes AB as capable of consenting. He goes into the bedroom, he lays down next to her. She notices that somebody's there, asks that person to move over. As he goes for the blanket, he asks her if she'd like to have sexual intercourse, and she does vomit at that point. And that is something to consider in this case, Your Honor. That's a fact among the factors.
Aesthetically, at least.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, the standard here is not whether AB was intoxicated. It's whether she was incapable of consenting. And the very next thing that Seaman Andrews describes is asking her if she would have sexual intercourse, and she verbally responds yes. Then she makes a physical movement of taking off her own pants and spreading her legs, and they had sexual intercourse in the missionary position. And then in terms of appreciating the nature of the sexual conduct, Seaman Andrews describes AB as able to appreciate the sexual conduct, that she's moaning during the sexual intercourse, that she pulls him closer to her, that she reaches around and scratches his back. And the scratches here are important. As the court will see in the record, they're corroborated by Petty Officer Kruger, who sees Seaman Andrews as he leaves the bedroom, sees the scratches on his back, describes them as fresh, draws a picture of what they look like, and that's in the joint appendix at 461. And I would submit to this court that's the hardest piece of evidence in the case.
So he had scratches on his back. I mean, that's like the great Harvard Law School sword. Which way does that cut? I mean, he had scratches on his back. I mean, is this done in a spasm of ecstasy, or was this done in, get off of me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, to me, that's at the very least ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor. And on that point, though, Petty Officer Kruger described them as the type of scratches that occur from pleasurable sexual intercourse. And if you look at the
I didn't know they differed.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at where the scratches are located on the lower part,
I'll take my okay. Maybe I should take my law from Petty Officer Kruger. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry about that.
After the sexual intercourse continued for a period of time, AB then reaches up, touches Seaman Andrews' head, and at that point makes and communicates the decision to stop the sexual intercourse. Both AB and Seaman Apprentice Andrews agree on that point, that she made and communicated the decision to stop, and at that point the sexual intercourse stopped. And then immediately following this sexual intercourse, AB gets out of bed, puts on her panties and goes to another bedroom where she describes that something happened to her. And she's able at that point to move, to go from bedroom to bedroom to describe what happened, demonstrating an awareness of her surroundings. And so this isn't just Seaman Andrews' statement. There's corroboration between Ms. Wade and Petty Officer Kruger. And again, this is a significant obstacle in the government's case, the evidence of consent, that AB was capable of consenting. And so turning then to the other two factors, the severity of the misconduct and the curative measures. So unlike Short and Hornback, the military judge...
Can I stop you for a minute in terms of strength of the evidence? So would it be your position that the evidence could be strong enough where a court of appeal could find that it was, at the CCA level, factually sufficient, and at our level, legally sufficient, but then not strong enough to counteract the severity of the misconduct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't know that that's the case here, but yes, because it's a balancing test among the three factors on Fletcher. So it's a balancing of the severity of the misconduct, the curative measures, and then the weight of the evidence.
So we could look at a case such as this one and say it's legally sufficient, and yet we could still find that the evidence was not strong enough to counterbalance the severe prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the driving question there is that did the members decide this case based on the evidence or the improper argument of counsel?
And this brings up something else to follow on Judge Olson. There seem to be these two concepts floating out there. One's prosecutorial misconduct, and the other is improper argument. Are they different? Are they the same? Do they shade into each other? Does it matter? Are there different standards? What are we dealing with here?
Well, Your Honor, specifically we're dealing with improper argument, which this Court has described as a form of prosecutorial misconduct.
Okay, it's a subset.
Yes, Your Honor. And then the prejudice analysis is determined whether, and this is the words from Fletcher, the misconduct was severe.
Right. No, I'm not dealing with that so much as the other, because there seems to be some sort of line drawn between the two. But your position is that one's just a subset of the other.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, Lieutenant Commander Mush, does that mean that you can have, well, put it this way, would you agree that you could have improper argument that a counsel, either a defense counsel or even a prosecutor, might say something that is unwarranted but not rise to the level of misconduct? Or is your view that all improper argument is per se misconduct on the part of the trial counsel?
Your Honor, the way the case law seems to bear it out, is that improper argument is a form of misconduct, the severity of which is determined in the second part of the Fletcher test.
That's but, wise. You're going to blame it on us.
yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, you are. I didn't know you would say yes, but you did. Okay, I understand that. So you're saying basically, based on our case law, that we have allowed the field and counsel to construe improper argument as per se misconduct. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Does it matter the blameworthiness of the trial counsel? You know, there's the old expression about even a dog knows the difference between being kicked and being tripped over. Here you've helpfully included in Appendix 2 information about assistant trial counsel being given an award for his 100% conviction rate. And in that, it includes the fact that he has handled 52 cases, 17 courts martial, and he is a military justice advisor for 20 commands in the Mid-Atlantic region. So we are confronted oftentimes with inexperienced trial counsel, inexperienced defense counsel. Here we're not confronted with that. We have someone who's quite experienced and someone who, if we were to adopt the views of the CCA, engaged in severe prosecutorial misconduct. Severe.
All that information that you put about the award and all that information, is it in the record or did you just decide to put it in your brief for decorative purposes?
Your Honor, it was included as an appendix to the supplement to the petition in this case. It was not part of the record.
So do you think it's appropriate for you to cite the things that are not part of the record?
It's cited as part of the supplement, Your Honor.
Is the supplement part of the record?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So in terms of the situation here, to what extent do we look when we're engaging in our balancing test? Do we look at the blameworthiness of the trial counsel, intentional versus accidental misconduct?
Yes, Your Honor. And so there are two parts to the answer to your question. The first part is it's the assessment, at least dealing in cases like Hornback, where it's an objective one. It's the impact on the trial and not the personal blameworthiness of the counsel. So in terms of balancing the factors there, the reason, to be candid, the reason I included that part in the brief was in response to a question this court asked the government in Pablona when talking about what do we do when we need to rein in trial counsel who have gone off the rails. And the government's position at that point in time was that simply talking about the misconduct in a forum like this was enough, that this was enough to deter, I guess, prosecutorial misconduct. And that award in referencing the 100% conviction rate is a clear signal from Navy JAG Corps leadership that what they care about, their concern, is the bottom line.
But getting to Judge Ryan's point, you're saying that personal blameworthiness is not part of the calculation. We have to look at it from the perspective of whether it affected the result in the trial. So is it the role of this court to look at Appendix 2 and to seek to be an advocate for one position or another as compared to this is something for something other than the judicial branch to get involved with, whether it is in the executive branch or Congress to say this isn't the way things should be conducted here? What's our role in terms of, if we're not looking at personal blameworthiness, to take to task someone who has engaged in professional misconduct, except for us looking at the issue of whether how strong the evidence was, whether the curative instructions actually were curative, and so forth?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, the personal blameworthiness of the prosecutor is not the test here. It's simply included to show that if the court is concerned about the misconduct in response to the question,
well,
to do about it.
And that's my question to you, is we can be extremely concerned about it, but what do we do about that properly? What is properly within our authority as a court, even if we are extremely concerned about severe prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes.
And also, counsel, you know, I don't know how you are intuiting from an award that that is what the Navy, that somehow the TJAG or the Navy or the Marine Corps desires that that counsel engage in prosecutorial misconduct or improper argument in order to get a 100% conviction rate. I mean, that's pure speculation on your part.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm not sure if I've addressed your question, Judge Olson, but I may, I see I'm getting low on time, and I'd like to talk about the severity of the misconduct, because the answer is this court applies the three-part balancing test, and Fletcher assesses the impact it had on the members, and then the court decides from there the issue before it.
Counsel, before you move on to the next subject, on the invented admission objection, the government says that that's the only issue that was objected to at trial. And it also persists in its brief in saying that this is really actually just reasonable inferences from what was said to the NCIS agent. You go over why, and you don't really reply to that in your reply brief, why isn't this just reasonable inferences?
Yes, Your Honor, and the short answer to that is it's not an inference when you call it evidence. So if you look in the joint appendix at page 410, and if the court will indulge me, the quote is, in fact, he says he was counting on the fact that I hope she will confuse me with Hills. Maybe she'll think I'm Hills. He's counting on it, and that's evidence that she was impaired, end quote. So I hope that she will confuse me with Hills is a statement that Petty Officer or Seaman Andrews never made.
Was that objected to?
It was objected to in the nature of uncharged misconduct because of the way in which it was linked to a theme in the case, like a thief in the night.
Well, no. Was it objected to as qua making something up?
Well, Your Honor, in a way it was, because uncharged misconduct is saying you're not on notice and able to defend against the new theory of liability. And it was alarming enough that the trial defense counsel wrote it down and brought it up to the judge immediately following the closing argument, the initial closing argument by the trial counsel. And I see that my time is about to expire, but if I may finish my response. And so it's not an inference when it's a statement that he never made. The trial counsel describes it as evidence that it's a fact and then uses it to establish that AB was impaired. And again, that comes on a crucial issue in a case, AB's level of impairment, which is, you'll see from the record, the members eventually convict Seaman Andrews.
Did the judge give the usual instruction that the arguments of counsel aren't evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, the judge did.
Okay.
I see my time has expired. Yes, Your Honor.
You have something else to say?
I have a lot more to say, Your Honor.
No.
But,
you have something to say that you can say in 30 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, the four types of improper argument here, you'll look across them, you'll see they all come back to the issue of impairment, AB's level of impairment, and it's the trial counsel steering the members towards a conviction on Specification 3 through the use of improper arguments. For that reason, Seaman Andrews would respectfully ask this court to set aside Specification 3 of Charge 5.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey and members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Captain Sean Monks, and I, together with Mr. Brian Keller, represent the United States. The United States prevails for three reasons. First, this court should find waiver under both RCM 919C and under United States v. Gladue. Second, the instances of error in plain error are fewer than what the lower court found. And third,
what? Say that again.
The instances of error in plain error are fewer than what the lower court found, Your Honor.
Okay.
And third, appellant suffered no prejudice under this court's Fletcher analysis and received a fair trial. As to the first reason the United States prevails, improper argument is waived under RCM 919C. That is a bright-line rule. There is no voluntariness required. This court recently followed the language of the rule in U.S. v. Ahern and should do so here. importantly, in Ahern, it said that this is not a case where the rule said waiver and actually meant forfeiture. Also in Ahern, that dealt with the 304A application of it, but also the use of that information in argument. This court said that the rule underlying appellant's claim also provides that his failure to object to the admission of the phone calls constitute waiver of his right to complain that they were used in this fashion, i.e., argument.
Counsel, is the issue of waiver properly before this court at this time?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It is, and that's because it goes to the severity analysis, so the impact, the severity impact, Your Honor. So the number of errors. If there is no error, then that impacts the severity test, the first prong of the Fletcher analysis.
Is the defense counsel correct in arguing that previous precedents of this court have treated failure to object to argument as a matter of forfeiture rather than waiver, notwithstanding what the RCM says?
In a head note in United States v. DeFoot, that is what this court has done. But recently in United States v. Ahern, this court did not do that.
But that was a different rule.
It was a different rule, yes, Your Honor.
So what have we done in cases recently where it was the same rule?
You have reviewed for forfeiture, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. But even if this court disagrees.
You're talking about a different rule and a different standard, but you concede that with the same rule, we're talking about forfeiture.
This court has previously held.
You're asking us, really, what it comes down to is you're asking us to ignore stare decisis.
No, Your Honor. We're asking this court to follow what it did in Ahern.
In a different rule.
In a different rule, but also.
As you've conceded, in terms of the same rule, we've applied forfeiture. So why would it not be an issue of stare decisis?
Well, Your Honor, because what happened in Ahern, but even if this court disagrees, its case law supports that waiver applies here under Gladue and Campos. So even if it declines to follow the bright line rule in RCM 919C, it should look to Campos and Gladue.
So you're not going to argue the principles behind when a court should ignore its prior precedent. You're simply going to point to Ahern with a different rule?
I mean, Ahern was dealing with a specific rule of evidence and specific language in the rule of evidence. It wasn't dealing with 919.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was dealing with a specific rule, but that specific rule.
It confused me for a second because I thought I remembered that case and I didn't think it had to do with argument.
Your Honor, it dealt with the rule. The rule itself had the language that failure to object constitutes waiver. That same language is in RCM 919, which governs this case. And in Ahern, it was also used in trial counsel's argument. But if this court declines to apply the RCM 919 bright line rule, it should look to whether or not this was an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And we know that because here defense counsel wrote down and specifically identified which words he had a problem with soon after in the 39A session. That's at Joint Appendix 414. He requested a tailored curative instruction, which he withdrew when the military judge offered the instruction coupled with another instruction as well. That's at Joint Appendix 417. He took a recess to think about whether or not he wanted this instruction, and that's at Joint Appendix 420, before he did not make any other objections and rested on asking for a mistrial for that one comment, and that's at Joint Appendix 423. Finally, and most importantly, he used the unobjected to portions tactically in his closing argument. That's at Joint Appendix 428, 31, 34, 41, and 43. And as this court said in United States v. Campos, many courts have taken the position that where there is no objection, and it is otherwise clear from the record that it was an intentional relinquishment of a known right, the doctrine of waiver shall apply. Now, ultimately, appellant's rights are still protected when this court follows the rules language or its precedent under Campos and Gladue, because he can still raise this under ineffective assistance of counsel claims, which are never waived. If there are no further questions, I'll turn to the second reason why the United States...
Let me ask you one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Monks. Isn't the ineffective assistance standard a bit higher?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So isn't that probably why defense counsel would rather bring a plain error claim as opposed to an ineffective assistance?
That's probably why they would like to do that, Your Honor, but he still preserves the right to preserve that issue in ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and that is the proper
point. Okay, well, let me ask you this, too. if we were to accept your view that parts of the argument that he did not object to were waived. And the part of the argument, at least in one instance, he objected to is reviewable. When you conduct, or when we conduct our review using the factors determine whether or not the accused was prejudiced or not, do we pretend like the other comments didn't occur? I mean, I think your view is that, hey, look, those weren't errors, so they shouldn't be included in a prejudice review. Is that how you look at it?
That's correct, Your Honor. If they're waived, then there is nothing to review. So in this case, if this court followed that line of thinking that it is waived, mm-hmm. you would review just that single comment that he objected to, and that would be for the mistrial, Your Honor.
Right, but doesn't that seem kind of interesting? I mean, the CCA has determined that a lot of this stuff was misconduct, this argument. And so aren't you kind of pretending like the other comments aren't there and you're only going to narrow our view to this one particular comment on the prejudice analysis?
Well, Your Honor, we don't want to pretend that the comments aren't there. We are saying that they were waived.
No, I'm not saying you would, but I mean, in order for us to conduct a prejudice analysis, isn't that what we have to kind of do?
This court would look at the
record. If we were to accept the waiver view.
If you were to accept the waiver view, you could look at the record in its entirety, Your Honor, to see if there was prejudice. But I disagree that there is totally waiver, and the United States disagrees with the lower court's finding of error in a lot of those instances, and specifically, and that brings me to the second reason that I talked about, Your Honor, which is that at least 8 of the alleged errors were not error at all.
Can I have you jump back, please, for a second?
Yes,
I want to make sure I understand your argument from a few minutes ago in regard to waiver. Is it your position if a trial defense counsel fails to object to something and then, in the course of their argument, uses the government's own point against them, that is evidence of waiver?
It is, Your Honor, because they tactically...
Is that a part of waiver, or is that in and of itself sufficient to demonstrate waiver?
It would be sufficient to demonstrate waiver because it shows his intent to relinquish the objection. The fact that he chose to go and argue that at the beginning shows that he intended to address it in his argument, and therefore that would be waiving the objection in the sense that it being improper argument if he had not objected, which he did not do so.
What if trial defense counsel didn't catch the issue, later at the end of trial says, this is in, I've got to do something with it? Does that still constitute waiver?
Well, Your Honor, if he has the right to object at any point, which is what he did at this case, which was at the end of the first closing summation. So any time, if he follows the rule, any time before the instructions are given, he can object. He can request a 39A. And so that's what he should do at this point. So if there are any further questions, Your Honor, I'd like to turn to the second one. Your Honor, first, there are at least 8 of the alleged errors were not error at all. And we looked to Meeks and Pablona, which looked at the rules, which is the ABA prosecution standard 3-6.8a.
Did the government certify any issue about the lower court being erroneous in its depiction or characterization of the arguments?
No, Your Honor, we did not.
Is that issue really before us at all?
It is, Your Honor, because it also has to deal with the severity analysis and whether or not there is, how many errors there were. So it is properly before this court.
Why can't we bifurcate the two? Why can't we look at it simply in terms of severity of misconduct, in terms of balancing? Why is Judge Ryan saying, is this issue preserved in terms of regurgitating what the CCA has done here?
I think that goes back to the question that was said earlier with, you know, is trial counsel's comment misconduct and is it not? So this court first has to find that it was error, and then it can go to the third prong. So it does.
But my point is that the CCA found that it was error, right? And you didn't certify that issue to us. And so, therefore, that part of the CCA's opinion, I think, we're stuck with. Now, the question as to whether it was prejudicial is before us, right? But the comments are what they are, and their characterization of them is also what it is.
That's correct, Your Honor. The question, though, the issue that was certified was, did the lower court err? That's a general question. Did it err in this case? And so we believe...
No, it's not a general question. You're talking about 8 examples. Tell us the 8 examples and what's going on here.
Yes, Your Honor. At Joint Appendix 396, the trial counsel argued that Petty Officer K says don't hook up with the victim, but the appellant says that Petty Officer K joked with him about maybe how he could get lucky with the victim. At Joint Appendix 397, the appellant says Petty Officer K came in and saw the appellant in bed with the victim and didn't say anything, but Petty Officer K and RW told appellant not to go in there. Petty Officer K also testified that
What do you not understand about, I mean, what is your point in bringing up these instances?
The point, Your Honor, is that there is no bright-line rule saying that liar.
Okay, except what do you not understand about my point, that the question is to whether those particular comments by trial counsel were erroneous or not is not before us. You can argue as to whether or not there was prejudice and why the appellant is wrong in saying that there is, but I, at least, don't want to hear anything more about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anyone else?
I actually do.
You do? Okay.
Counsel, it's up to you.
I will endeavor to keep it short, Your Honor, because I don't want to lose time. So in this case, this court should look to the rule. There is no bright-line rule about the language in terms of liar and lying. The D.C. Circuit Court has said that it's not error for the prosecution to call someone a liar. That's in Dean, Donato, and Gartman. In this case, also, the trial counsel is allowed to make reasonable inferences from the evidence and to argue the record to highlight any inconsistencies or inadequacies of the defense and to forcefully assert reasonable inferences from the evidence. And that's what he did, and that's what I'm directing this court to. In Joint Appendix 397, the trial counsel also argued that the appellant denied knowing about the relationship with the victim and Petty Officer H, even though Petty Officer K told him about it at the beach. And also in Joint Appendix 400, the prosecutor said he's lying about it, and here's why, and you can see it, and then he proceeded to go through. So that encompasses about 8 instances, Your Honor, and that's why. Turning to the third reason, though, that the United States prevails, is that this case is exactly like United States v. Sewell. It's very, very similar. In that case, there were mixed findings. It was not guilty to uncorroborated evidence, and the appellant was guilty to some corroborated evidence, and that is the same case here. In that case, the trial counsel made improper statements during argument. Some of those errors were preserved, such as what kind of man has 118 pictures of his penis on his phone, and it's someone who won't take no for an answer when sending pics and when he's sexually assaulting someone. Those arguments were preserved. But the arguments that were not preserved, which are similar to those that the appellant alleges here, are the additional propensity arguments, improper vouching, references to facts not in evidence, and statements that purportedly inflamed the passions of the panel. For example, calling the appellant in that case an old, dirty man in a trench coat.
Okay, but let's stick with this case. Let's not rehash that case. Why doesn't standing alone, regardless of this 25 times invocation of the fact that the accused was a liar, was lying, oftentimes untethered to specific instances, why wouldn't standing alone, the assertion of government counsel, that the defense doesn't believe their own client, why shouldn't that cause this court to find that the prosecutorial misconduct was severe in terms of going through this balancing test? Essentially, you have a trial counsel saying to the fact finders, hey, I have some inside knowledge that, in fact, the person who is defending the accused doesn't believe him. Why isn't that an outrageous statement?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the record supports the fact that he said, I have some inside knowledge.
No, but what the record does support is the defense doesn't believe their own client, and there are certainly inferences that are going to be drawn, and which you could suppose the government counsel was seeking to have drawn, and therefore the reason for that statement.
Your Honor, that was an improper thing to say. But this court can also look to its rules in United States v. Gilley, which is the invited response doctrine. So previously, the appellant, trial civilian defense counsel, had argued that the government did not believe their own client, didn't believe their star witness. And in this case, that
is... Wait a minute. Your response is ultimately, you argued the same thing, so we can.
No, Your Honor, it is.
Well, that's certainly what it sounds like to me.
The second part of what I'm going to say, Your Honor, is that He also, right after that, said that this is why they don't believe their own client. An improper thing to say, but he's trying to link it to the fact that appellant said something in his NCIS interview, and that, you know, maybe she thought I was someone else. And then at trial, he's arguing that she was embarrassed.
Counsel, so, rather than trying to basically stick up for or justify what was said at trial, can you please turn to why there was no prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. So looking at the three prongs in Fletcher, if this court declines to apply waiver, the severity prong, the first one is that, you know, the numbers were relatively low. It was 11 pages of a 31-page closing argument.
Because you're running out of time, and I think this is consistent with what Judge Ryan was trying to get at, can you talk about the strengths of the government's case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's undisputed evidence, and that's at Joint Appendix 187, 135 through 37, 46 through 49, and 153, that four other witnesses, including appellant, saw that the victim was extremely intoxicated, that she was slurring her words, that she was non-responsive to people. Other people located vomit on the bed next to her head. In fact, appellant said that she vomited right next to him before proceeding to have sex with her, something that is not an aesthetic quality, Your Honor. That is evidence.
Oh, I'd say it's aesthetic. It may be other things as well.
It may be, but that is not just supported by appellant. That's supported by Petty Officer
Kay. Well, okay. So she was drunk and she threw up. She also took her pants down.
She doesn't remember that, Your Honor. R.W. testified to that.
Is there evidence of record that she took her pants down?
There is, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. We're skating awful close to factual sufficiency here, but that's the line of argument you seem to be pursuing. Go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, also to the strength of the case, the victim testified that she blacked out, she woke up to appellant, she pushed him off, and then she blacked out again. And that at around 0400, according to Petty Officer K, she came in. We don't know exactly how much time elapsed between when it happened, but she came back in to Petty Officer K in RW's room. She said, I think something happened, and then she proceeded to vomit again in the restroom. The important thing, too, is that appellant knew that she was intoxicated throughout the night. He saw that. He also knew that she had expressed no interest in him, and that...
Wait a minute. She's drunk. Presumably, so is everybody else. But are you saying, is the government's position that she's drunk, therefore it's per se criminal?
No, Your Honor.
Saying.
No, Your Honor. The fact that she was...
You're saying he should have stayed away from her. Well, he probably thinks that today, but that's not really the point, is it?
No, Your Honor. The point was her capacity. She was incapacitated, and the evidence supports that. Other witnesses saw her extreme level of intoxication, her unresponsiveness. She herself testified as to that fact. And additionally, I'm running out of time here, the members' findings indicate that he was convicted on the evidence alone. On the second prong, the military judge gave the standard curative instruction both before and after closing arguments. And the trial counsel, in terms of the mixed findings, the trial counsel asked them to convict on all three specifications. They only returned with a guilty verdict on one of those specifications. I'd like to conclude.
Please do.
Appellant received a fair trial under this court's test, and it should affirm. This court should apply waiver to unobjected to arguments, which would follow the rule in this court's case law, and still preserve an appellant's ability to challenge improper argument through ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
May it please the court. Briefly, I'd like to focus in on the impact that the improper arguments had on the members in this trial. And the government discussed a little bit Sewell and the acquittals in Sewell. And unlike Sewell, where the acquittals seemed to track the evidence, here the acquittals track the improper arguments. The acquittals drive the members towards specification 3 to find that Seaman Andrews was guilty because AV was incapable of consenting due to impairment by alcohol. And in terms of the impact and focusing in on the accusation that the defense doesn't believe their own client, the second sentence there is very important. The defense doesn't believe their own client. Their own client says she didn't know it was me. Again, that's referencing back to this invented admission that the trial counsel produced during closing argument. And again, it goes to the issue of impairment. So, and there are at least four aspects why this is probably the most damaging improper argument of them all. One, it's an attack on the integrity of the attorneys themselves. Two, it adds another level on the liar comments, implying that that Stephen Andrews is such a liar that not even his own counsel believe him. And third, it's referenced to, or it's tethered to the impairment, the invented admission, and finally it came in rebuttal, which undercut all of defense counsel's closing argument because it went to their integrity.
Counsel, do you have a position as to whether this court can or should revisit the CCA's determination as to error with respect to certain statements?
Yes, Your Honor, we're not challenging the lower court's findings of error. The appellant's position is that's not properly before the court, and that this court's analysis should focus on the second half of the prejudice analysis, and that's consistent with cases such as Defoot and Fry, where this court just looked at the prejudice analysis. And again, the waiver issue is not properly before the court either. Under RCM 919, we're dealing with the plain error that was found by the lower court. In sum, because of the improper argument by trial counsel, the uncured improper arguments that they used to bolster their weak case and convict Seaman Andrews of sexual assault, this court cannot be confident the member sentenced him on or convicted him on the evidence alone. Also, I would like to mention that this impacted his sentence because he had a pretrial agreement that was contingent upon the finding in the sexual assault offense. And as a result, he was deprived of the sentencing cap that was in his pretrial agreement because of the finding of guilty on Specification 3 of Charge 5. And with that, I'd ask the court to set aside Specification 3 of Charge 5. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court stands in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. The court stands in recess pending further order of the court.